You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon. I'd like to thank everyone for joining us here on the internet to talk about the impact of coronavirus on small businesses, especially restaurants and retail. I'm joined today, I'm Tracy Lowe, and I'm a fellow with the Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program, and I'm joined today by Dr. Annalise Goger, who is an expert in workforce development policy and implementation, safety net programs, and global supply chains at Brookings with me. She's conducted 13 interviews in the past 2 weeks with workers, managers, and owners in the restaurant industry to find out what's happening, what the biggest challenges these workers and owners are facing, and what forms of support would be most helpful by right now. You can look for our research briefs on Brookings.edu published in the last week for findings from those interviews and a deep dive on the unemployment insurance system. I'm also joined by Eric Shin, who is the founder of Soul Spice, a fast casual restaurant serving Korean comfort food with locations in DC and College Park in Prince George's County in Maryland. His three storefronts employ about 40 people and feature his mother's recipes with a contemporary twist. And finally, I'm joined by David Iannucci, who has served Maryland and Prince George's County as an economic development professional for decades. Prince George's County is immediately adjacent to the east, to Washington, D.C., and has about 1 million people. He's currently the president and CEO of Prince George's County's Economic Development Corporation under County Executive Angela Also Brooks, and that includes oversight of the county's $50 million Economic Development Incentive Fund, which has leveraged over $1.1 billion in private sector investments. So we've been particularly interested in the impacts to bars and restaurants because these enterprises were among the first to be affected by this crisis, and because the industry is well known for low profit margins and for limited worker protections. We also care because bars and restaurants are critical to the economic ecosystem of main streets everywhere. And since the Great Recession, that's a category that's grown quite a bit, even as retail overall has struggled. And as of 2016, leisure and hospitality jobs outnumber retail jobs in the United States. So Annalise, I'd like to start by turning to you. And can you tell us what you heard from workers and businesses and what's happening out there?
So in a word, I would just say it's been crushing. And you know, I've done thousands of interviews throughout my career, and this is the first time where I've almost every one I had to take some time after to decompress. And so they were so heavy in terms of emotionally heavy and disturbing in terms of how unexpected it was and how unprepared people were. They are living paycheck to paycheck. A lot of them either don't have health insurance or they're about to lose it. So I spoke with one bartender, for example, and she, you know, her employer didn't actually even tell her her shift was canceled. They didn't call her or anything. She just heard the mayor's announcement and thought she shouldn't go in. And then a couple of days later, they got an email. And she has no health insurance, and she's really worried about, you know, how am I going to manage if I get this virus? If I go into the hospital, am I going to pay $20,000, you know, in bills? And then she tried calling unemployment because she was worried about paying her rent. And she was on hold for 6 hours, and she went through the process. She said they were very helpful, but then they spelled her name wrong. So I heard later from her that she had to call back. And, you know, so it's just a really dire situation. And I observed that she was fluctuating during the interview from trying to talk herself out of it, saying, you know, I've done this before. I have ramen noodles. I can do this. And then just total overwhelm. So I think that, you know, this conveys some of the ways in which people are really acutely stressed in this industry. And I think Eric and Dave can talk more about the business owner perspective.
Yeah, Eric, can you tell us what you're hearing from your restaurant peers?
Sure. It's It's devastating. Every single restaurant is suffering right now. And in particular, I think the smaller local restaurants are really bearing the brunt of the economic damage, especially now with diners sheltering at home. Restaurants are either closing their doors to weather the storm or they're repurposing their businesses to try and generate revenue. Businesses are all scrambling to access funding through these programs such as economic injury disaster loans, payroll protection program, but there's also been a lot of confusion on how to apply for these loans, and each bank has a completely different process and different set of requirements. The bigger banks have also added restrictive language, and this language limits the applications that they can receive to current banking customers. Some of these banks even require having a credit card with that institution. Furthermore, the funding isn't really categorized for different industries. It's just one pot of money. So you have the most vulnerable businesses competing for the same loans with the larger companies. This all really adds to a growing sense of urgency to receive this funding before the funding runs out. Businesses are closing every single day, and I don't know of any business owners who have actually received a loan disbursement from the program yet.
May I ask, Eric, have you applied for the Paycheck Protection Program?
I have. We did apply, and we are waiting to hear back. The general feeling is that all these institutions are trying to work out how to process these applications, and we're all just waiting to see what happens.
And David, what's happening in Prince George's County? How has coronavirus impacted the Prince George's County economy? And what's your restaurant expert telling you?
Well, appreciate the chance to talk about this. Restaurants, of course, are always one of the most difficult new sectors. The turnover in restaurant industry in a good economy is pretty challenging. And as the other speakers have said, Eric and Annalise has said, it's a devastating time in Prince George's County for the restaurant industry and for hospitality industry. The predictions are that the Washington metropolitan area overall is going to go minus 1% on GDP in the next year or so. And Prince George's County is going to, unfortunately, is going to share that burden. It took us 5 years to add 21,000 jobs in Prince George's County and lead the state of Maryland for job growth. We've had 26,000 layoffs in the last 4 weeks. Those are heavily in the restaurant, the retail, and the hospitality industry. So there are predictions that have been made both regionally and nationally that the restaurant industry, somewhere between 35% and 75% of restaurants will not come back from this disaster. And we're very, very much worried about that. Restaurants are a big part of the economic development strategy of Prince George's County to create the amenities to support the workforce that we want to have here and that is here. So this is, as has been said, this is a very devastating time for the restaurant industry in the United States and locally in Prince George's County.
Thanks for that, David. Those are some hard numbers to hear. It's hard to watch 5 years of growth evaporate almost overnight. So let's explore a little more what options restaurants even have to try to stay open and keep revenue coming in. Eric, can you tell us what you're doing with your business?
Sure. Well, before the pandemic, it was definitely a different picture. Business was booming. We're on the verge for a big multi-unit expansion. But then, of course, this all happened. And instead, we ended up pivoting to launch Heart and Soul, which is our mobile bodega. And the idea is to better serve our communities. And it works by leveraging our relationships with our vendors. So we're able to deliver essential supplies and high quality food to the communities at prices lower than a grocery store. I think this is really important for a lot of reasons, but especially for our employees, it gives us extra revenue to provide more compensation through the bodega sales, tips, and donations. I think a lot of restaurants are trying different things to survive right now. Now that dine-in is not an option, there's this really, really sharp decline in takeout sales. And I think the average is somewhere around 80%. It's probably more now, honestly. But there is a slight increase in online ordering, delivery sales, curbside pickup, no contact options. These are all viable options for generating revenue. But the bottom line is, you know, people aren't going out. They're at home, they're sheltering, and, restaurants aren't thriving. They're just surviving.
What kind of response are you getting to the bodega?
It's been really amazing, actually. We've seen a really big response in the high-risk community, and, just the idea of someone risking their life to get a dozen eggs is just crazy, you know? So we found a real need to get essential items like paper towels, toilet paper, sanitizer, things like that to the community. And you know, you go to the grocery store and these aisles are empty, but our vendors are actually losing so much business with the restaurants closing, and they have lots of these products on their shelves. So I think as a restaurant owner, we're uniquely positioned to connect our vendors with the community just in a different way.
That's an interesting insight that, food and product supply chains are not as flexible as one might have hoped that they would be. I'd like to hear more about how you're hoping to use the Paycheck Protection Program. So has Soul Spice had to lay anybody off?
Not yet. Our goal is to keep our doors open and to keep our employees employed. The Paycheck Protection Program, it offers some support for sure. It helps cover payroll costs. It'll keep restaurants afloat and payroll for 8 weeks, but I think more needs to be done. It doesn't really, because it's limited to payroll, if a restaurant's closed, it doesn't really provide adequate support and just really doesn't address the immediate needs for all the different expenses a restaurant needs to stay open. When you think of the cash flow a restaurant needs, I mean, most restaurants don't have the cash flow to survive 3 months without revenue. I mean, let alone 1 month. And I think that's valid for not just the smaller local businesses, but larger chains too. It's just, you know, the business model is not designed to operate without revenue. And to that end, with the PPP loans, I think right now we really need a simpler, more streamlined way to apply for the funding. And we definitely need to be able to receive the funds quicker.
But you make a good point that the bottom line is that many businesses have already closed and that tens of millions of workers across the United States have already been laid off. Annalise, what's happening to them?
Well, you know, that's one of the things I wish we had had more early decisive leadership on from Congress in terms of how to keep these payrolls flowing and to avoid, to treat layoffs as a last resort. And unfortunately, what's happening is that our unemployment systems, as you've probably all heard this morning, they're still jammed and slammed, and they're very stressed right now. These are systems operating off of data systems from the 1980s, and they have to be reprogrammed to implement three new programs from the CARES Act on the fly. Imagine being a state administrator right now, and you already have, you know, millions of people coming at your front door. It's realistically going to take two or three more weeks before these changes can be implemented. And, you know, I think it really symbolizes that our safety net was not working for the affected populations in this pandemic, and that's a huge problem. And, you know, moving forward, I hope we can do as much as we can to A, get money out to existing community organizations that can provide fast relief, whether it's chambers or economic development or philanthropy, community development financial institutions. And B, we should be building on programs we have tested, such as one that's not well known called short-time compensation or work share. We should be saying, you know, don't lay people off, reduce their hours. We're going to make it easy for you to apply, and you can collect benefits and keep your health insurance. We should be doing that type of thing. We have programs already that we could tweak to make this happen, and I hope to see more of that decisive action to save businesses and prevent jobs from going away.
So didn't the CARES Act do something for workers who are laid off and who will be collecting unemployment? There's a top up to the maximum unemployment benefit. Is that correct?
Yes. So the benefits are very generous once they're implemented. Each person who either receives regular unemployment insurance or is what's called under pandemic unemployment insurance, it's one of the new programs. Whether you're on partial unemployment, which means your hours were reduced, or full unemployment, you will all receive an additional $600.
And Is that per month, per week?
Per week.
Okay.
And that will be retroactive. So if you can't get through for 3 weeks and you're trying every day, it might be better to wait a couple of weeks, honestly, just to get the staff trained and the systems, you know, more prepared for this. But basically, it'll be retroactive to either when you lost your hours or your job or January 27th. And then on top of that, the pandemic unemployment assistance expands unemployment access to groups of workers that typically would not be eligible for UI. So that includes 1099 workers that are self-employed or gig workers. And a lot of folks who worked part-time who wouldn't meet the income thresholds for regular unemployment insurance. So this is all very good. It's just trying to get agencies that, again, are very strained. They were at historically low levels of staff before this happened. You know, trying to get them up to speed to handle this demand is really challenging. And so I think in the meantime, we need to think about what's the immediate solution that we can get to community organizations and food banks immediately to help provide some relief while people are waiting for this to come through.
And David, Prince George's County is already acting quickly and decisively. I saw that the Greater Washington Community Foundation is partnering with your workforce nonprofit to try to get $200 cash cards in the hands of workers in Prince George's County who've been laid off. That is absolutely fantastic. How many workers do you think that program will be able to reach?
That is a program run by our employee Prince George's County, our colleague Walter Simmons, and they're trying to raise enough funds to get that money to 2,000 Prince George's County workers making $19 an hour or less. And the idea is to raise $500,000 collectively so that people can get essentially a credit card or debit card of $200 value per week. Those are for folks who might otherwise fall through the cracks on the various unemployment programs. And you know, as everything that Anjali said, that there are long delays. There's nobody who had the infrastructure in place at the federal level, at the state level, frankly, at the local level, to deal with the onslaught of these unemployment applications. I know in Prince George's County, we received in a 2-week period as many kind of business layoff notices as we would normally receive in a 12-month period. And everyone is working very hard to address that. So this COVID hourly worker relief program was stood up by County Executive Alsobrooks and EPG and to meet that immediate need for those workers.
And I'd actually like to make one more point, which is someone who's not covered in this CARES Act, which are undocumented workers. So when I interviewed folks and I asked them, who do you think is most vulnerable in this situation? In every instance, the answer was usually the dishwashers who are low paid and often undocumented, or immigrants who have legal authorization, but they were very concerned about undocumented workers. I know that Minneapolis has created a relief fund that is $5 million. And I hope that we'll start to see some other localities consider funds that those families can access, because right now they can't, they can't travel home. And, it's really going to be severely impacting that community.
I could add that when you look at the retail and the restaurant and the hospitality workforce in general, it generally does skew younger. They're heavily in this region, certainly a large African-American and Latino population. And those folks are going to be the most vulnerable. They're the ones who are losing their jobs first because of the pandemic and because of what's happening to the retail, the restaurant, and the hospitality industry. And so a great deal of effort has to be made to make sure that they literally don't just fall through the cracks and there's nothing there to help them. It's a very difficult time.
Indeed. Eric, how long do you think Soul Spice can hang on with everything that's happening? Whether you get a Paycheck Protection Program loan or not, what are your books looking like? What's your calendar?
Well, it's we're just hanging on, really. We're doing everything we can to just try to pay all our debts and keep the money flowing to our employees. As far as restaurants that are open and hanging on, it's really about being able to act quickly and creatively. It's really more of a sense of buying time rather than, thriving. And in order to survive without assistance, I mean, every business needs to reassess how they're doing their processes, how they're doing things, to be relevant during this pandemic. That said, even the businesses that stay open and get through to the other side of this, I mean, we're all going to need assistance for all these economic hardships. I mean, this epidemic, it hasn't spared anyone. And again, speaking of assistance, it really goes back to smaller local business. I mean, these businesses are the cultural and economic backbones of our communities, and they need all the help that they can get. And I really, really hope that all the future bills and support will offer some sort of protections to make sure that funding is allocated directly to these businesses rather than, everyone having to compete for that same pot of money.
Yeah. One thing I'd like to raise, kind of building off of what Eric and Dave said, is, in the Great Recession, white-owned businesses survived about 60%, but black-owned businesses only 49%. And so in addition to, the health disparities that we're seeing based on race, typically women-owned businesses, black-owned businesses, Latino-owned businesses, they have a harder time getting finance. And, one of my concerns with the PPP is that it's first come, first serve, and a lot of these banks coming out the gate were only working with people they already worked with. And so, I think it's starting to shift, but, that's going to put the mom and pop, the smaller folks, the folks that need more help, at the back of the line. And so my question for policymakers is, what kind of technical assistance infrastructure can we set up for those smaller businesses that need help not only accessing the program, but also once you get a loan, making sure that you know how to document what you need to document to get reimbursed for a payroll. Because these are all processes that a lot of businesses in the sector aren't necessarily used to navigating.
David, it seems to me that given that Prince George's County is majority Black and Latino, that those numbers Annalise just shared are going to, that means that we're looking at a really disparate impact for Prince George's County, even within the D.C. region as a whole. What's your take on that at EDC, and do you guys have plans for how to respond?
Well, I think it's a shared burden. I mean, our counties all around the region, and as you know, we collaborate recently with the six Maryland suburban counties, and we're all on a weekly basis. My colleagues are talking about this. Challenging as in Prince George County, I know that every one of them are going through the same difficult time. Every one of us are watching our restaurant industry decline. Our hotels are literally closed across the board. Our retail was already struggling. So I feel, if you will, a little comfort in the sense that I've got colleagues who are going through the same thing. And I don't know that it'll be that disproportionate. It is going to be rough in general for Maryland, for the Eastern United States, and for the nation. But we're the wealthiest majority African-American community in the United States. This is a well-educated population. We've got tremendous assets. We're home. I know people are watching from around the country. We're home to the University of Maryland College Park, NASA Goddard, and a very, very educated workforce. We're going to come through this. We are leading the state of Maryland at one point, and I know at the end of this, we will as well. Now, County Executive Alsa Brooks did stand up a local COVID business relief program to especially deal with the Prince George's County businesses, small businesses that are falling through the cracks, if you will. We're trying to supplement what the state of Maryland has done. The state of Maryland has put more than $150 million into programs. They have more than 20,000 applications, and they've already had to shut the door on those. $350 billion for the federal program struck me as a lot of money. And I know all of us at the local government level, going back to your original question, we need the Small Business Administration and the federal government to lead the way. There is no local government in the United States that can carry this burden by itself. The type of numbers that Eric has talked about, the type of demand for money is in the hundreds of billions of dollars. My own county, and just again, just like the counties in Maryland and Virginia and the District of Columbia as well, they're all seeing their own revenue base close. When people aren't working, when they're not eating in restaurants, when they're not and traveling and so forth, the county revenues are going to shrink. So counties are going to feel this burden at a time when they need the greatest resources. They're going to be struggling to come up with those resources themselves. And that's where we need the federal government. The federal government has to carry the heaviest burden. Again, $350 billion just a week and a half ago seemed like a lot of money. You read the headline today, and there's already discussion about another $250 billion. And that's because the SBA obviously sees that money going out the door very quickly. And I'll be honest, our $15 million local business relief fund, which will be standing up next week, and we'll be taking applications next week.
Take notes on that.
It's a grant component and a loan component. I have no doubt that we're going to be, the demand on that is going to exceed the resources that we have. We're going to do the best we can to help businesses as quickly as we can. I know we're going to be very, very responsive. And perhaps because of our size, we can get dollars out the door a little quicker than the other folks. But I'm sympathetic to the state. I'm sympathetic to the federal government on the struggles they are to handle the onslaught. I think I read that the federal government had over 400,000 applications. And they're probably used to, on a normal basis, handling, you know, a couple thousand applications a week, maybe 5,000 or 10,000 a week, and they have 400,000 in the nation. I have to admit that we all have to know that's a challenge.
I'd like to add, you know, another thing. I talked about technical assistance for companies applying for loans, but I also think another area for technical assistance might be for firms like Eric's that are trying to make a switch into delivery models and online, you know, various ways in which you can respond to the need right now. So it's happening all the way up the food chain, right? Because before this, more than 50% of meals, what people are spending on meals was being consumed outside the home. And then almost overnight, it's switching to home. So that means that there's a whole supply chain there that's affected of food and wholesalers and so on. And so it's not that grocery stores don't have, that there's not enough food out there. It's just that they don't typically, those wholesalers don't usually connect to those stores or connect directly to homes. And so how do you innovate in those areas? I think there's really room for municipalities and economic development officials and philanthropy to think about what kind of trainings could you offer online? You know, here's how you can stand up, you know, a solution for this problem. Here's some things to look out for, that kind of thing.
I have a question for Eric, because it's our sense in Prince George's County that the restaurants that are doing the best in dealing with this crisis are those that already had a good online or experience that this is not something brand new to them, that they were doing online orders, they were doing takeout deliveries and so forth. They seem to have a leg up. Eric, would you agree with that?
Absolutely, 100%. I mean, our entire way we interact with our customers changed overnight. We went from greeting customer, you know, personally to receiving emails or an online order. So I think that was one of the things that helped us adapt really quickly. We were able to create an online platform within 24 hours. And there are a lot of businesses that are struggling to release like an online platform for their products. So there's definitely a big need for that. Any help with technology and just redefining the way that people order food.
I'd like to also remind our audience that you can ask our panelists here questions via Twitter using the hashtag COVIDBizClosures. That's biz with a Z, COVIDBizClosures. We are staying tuned for your questions.
I have a question for Eric. How did you think through safety of your workers? You know, if we are going to put people out there, you know, how do you think through that?
Well, that's a great question. Of course, safety is like, you know, our top priority, especially now. And when you think about all the businesses that are operating, that are serving the community, really what we're doing is one of the safest jobs, because we take a delivery order in the store through a computer. And, you know, we're not in a grocery store situation where we're just dealing with hundreds and thousands of people. It's pretty isolated. And as far as our delivery service, our drivers, you know, they drop the groceries off at the doorsteps. There's no interaction with the customer. So it's fairly safe. We've also added a bunch of different cleaning protocols for the store. We're sanitizing like high touch surfaces every hour. We're wearing masks. We're wearing gloves. It's a big change.
Eric, I'm interested in the fact that earlier you mentioned that prior to this crisis, you were planning to expand your business. Given everything that's happening now, do you anticipate ever getting back to those plans?
I really hope so. I think we definitely want to expand, but I think we'll have to take a look at how our customers order food, how we engage our customer. This is going to have a lasting effect for every restaurant, and we're going to have to redefine how we serve the community. It's not like these social distancing measures will be lifted and then suddenly everyone's out and crowding the streets, right? There's going to be a slow transition, and you know, we're going to have to see if our business is viable in that situation. And it just really pushes the brakes, I think, for expansion for any business in the food industry.
Yeah. How have you been getting the word out about the bodega?
We've been partnering with a lot of Main Street programs. Tinleytown Main Street and the BID programs have been sending tweets and listservs. Typically, the customers that we deliver to will, you know, there's a lot of word of mouth. They'll tell their neighbors. It's pretty organic, really. There's just a really big need for it right now. So it's really been great.
That's good. That's good to hear. And that's how I heard about the Soul Spice Bodega program. I got an email from Tinleytown Main Street saying that, you know, Whole Foods is out of salt, but that Soul Spice is not. we have a few questions coming in from Twitter. Eric, have you tried to seek rent relief from your landlord? Did you pay rent on April 1st? And have you talked to your landlord about what you're going through?
I have. Right now, I think all landlords are navigating the process as well. we're doing our best to honor our leasing agreements and to pay rents. But it's difficult. I mean, things are tight. I think most businesses aren't in a position where they can afford their rent, let alone utilities, anything. So I think there's a really big need for financial assistance that addresses, you know, these core business costs, not just payroll, especially for restaurants that have closed their doors and are just trying to support their employees. And there's a definite need to address that.
Yeah, some of the owners I spoke to, one had rent of $25,000 a month. And, you know, that's just, you can't even imagine how you're going to keep up with that if there's no revenue coming in. And another one was a small stand in a mall. And, you know, they only had, you know, it was a family-run business, and they had one full-time employee and two part-time people. And, you know, they didn't know how they were going to pay the rent even for the little stand. And they hadn't heard anything from the mall management in terms of, you know, how are they going to get through this period. So from very tiny all the way up to large, I think this the rent is a huge problem. And, you know, some cities have
moratoriums.
Yeah, moratoriums on commercial rent in addition to residential rent. So that's certainly something to think about, especially if it's taking a while for this money to flow to people.
Yeah, I mean, in Maryland, the Governor Hogan has put a moratorium on both. Initially, it was on residential foreclosures, evictions, and so forth, and now it's been extended to commercial. So it does, you know, obviously the demand is there, the obligation is there, but there will not be immediate consequences in terms of anyone. Frankly, we have, you know, as it moves up the chain, you've got the landlords who have their own mortgages with, and they need then in turn, they need to get relief on their debt with the banks. It's one thing for a tenant not to pay $10,000 or $20,000 or some amount like that. The landlord himself might have a $500,000 or $300,000 note per month on a $50 or $100 million debt. And so I think we have to look to the banks for them to be, I think, just to have a humanitarian and sympathetic understanding of what's happening all up down the chain. Otherwise, we could completely collapse the economy if there's not really sympathy at every level. I'm very sympathetic for Eric. But the person who he's not paying rent to is going to be in trouble as well. So we need a lot of people at all levels to be accommodating.
I think that's a great point, David. And, you know, it's a lot of restaurant owners don't think about the after effects of closing a restaurant. And it's, you know, that's also very devastating. I mean, you're cutting revenue off all of your vendors, all of your landlords. You know, they lose revenue, then they cut staff, and then they can't afford to pay their bills, and goes all the way up the top of the food chain and just contributes to that economic downward spiral. It's definitely a
One of our first layoff notices that we received in Prince George County was from a wholesale produce company that we immediately took a second to understand. They supply produce, vegetables, produce, et cetera, to the restaurant industry. So when the restaurants first closed, they lost their customers, and they laid off in Prince George County 450 people, the wholesale.
Yeah, one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about is, how can we redeploy our rapid response teams, you know, which usually respond to mass layoffs? The WARN notice system is for layoffs of 50 or more, but this is a situation where you have a lot of smaller businesses at one time. So how can we retool our rapid response teams to provide some direct support to businesses right now, and also, you know, other agencies that are employer-facing, like incumbent worker training programs? Some states have pretty large programs, and they have networks to support employers, and they have staff trained in working with employers. And so I've been thinking a lot about how could that take some of the burden off the unemployment system, and try to, you know, if that's where you're going to stand up some assistance to get people into Workshare to avoid layoffs, or programs to help people find access to loans, like, you know, building on some of those at the state level, there's some of those assets. At the local level, you have your, you know, folks like Dave and Chambers and, you know, community development financial institutions.
David, we've got a question for you from Twitter, which is that you mentioned that, you know, you're looking down the pike and seeing that Prince George's County and the state of Maryland's revenues are going to be very negatively impacted by everything that's happening on the sales tax front. And certainly, you know, if folks can't pay rent, that means that property owners are going to be struggling to pay property taxes. So there could be multiple kind of stacking impacts coming at public sector budgets. How is Prince George's County funding the relief programs that it's doing, and what's that going to look like going forward?
Well, the third stimulus that passed includes money for direct payments to county governments as well as city governments. And I'm not the budget person in the county whose job I'm very sympathetic to right now. I understand that, and I don't know if it's over multiple fiscal years, but the county might be in line for $175 to $200 million. And that essentially will fill a hole that will be paid by the drop in revenues, both from the income tax in Maryland that goes to local government, and then real estate taxes. Though the real estate taxes will, for the most part, will hold steady, but clearly we're going to see a drop in revenue. So there are direct payments from the federal government that will be part of that. But again, it comes at a time where the demand for resources is at its peak on a really emergency level, when in the short term those revenues will be short. So I think that speaking as a director of an organization that is funded by Prince George's County, and again, I know my colleagues all through the state of Maryland are in the same boat, we are anticipating getting a phone call from the budget office telling us there's about 5% of your budget you don't get to spend because we're going to take it back. And you know, we'll deal with that professionally because we have to. But that's probably how it'll play out. I mean, the county is very well managed. County Executive Angela Ulsberg has got a great team in place. We've been through the recession. We survived the recession, and that was very difficult as well. And we will get through this, but it's not going to be fun. Again, the federal government direct payments, I think, will be the biggest opportunity for relief.
Understanding that resources are finite right now for the relief program that you're running, is your program going to be first come, first serve, or are you looking at other strategic ways to prioritize in terms of your strategy for the economy of Prince George's County?
We're going to have some hard discussions. And one of the issues, and Eric may be sympathetic to this, I mean, there are, again, restaurants have always been a tough industry. So there are restaurants, if you look back, they might have been struggling before the pandemic hit. And we will probably have to make some very hard judgments. Do they have a chance to survive after the pandemic? Because we ultimately want to save the workers. The ultimate goal of this is to save the business so the business can continue to make its payroll obligations and keep employees there. So will our county dollars be best spent on a restaurant or a retail operation or a small business that we think will have a better chance to survive the pandemic, continue to operate, continue to employ Prince George's County citizens? Those will be some hard decisions. The money is going to go out the door very quickly, though. I am aware of that. My colleagues in the FSC First and Economic Development Corporation, my staff, we're all gearing up for this massive onslaught of demand that will exceed the dollars we have. And we will be moving as quickly as we can to process applications to get the dollars out. And understanding at all times, this is taxpayer dollars. So I have an obligation to the citizens of Prince George's County to make sure their dollars are well spent. And that means feeling comfortable that when we put money out the door, that we think, given the terms of the repayment and so forth, that we're likely to get it back.
I hear what you're saying. We have another question from Twitter, this one for Annalise. And actually, Eric, you might be interested to comment on this too, because you're adapting your business into a whole new format, and that means a whole new set of things that you need from your workers, you know, maybe a different set of skills than you had in mind when you hired them in the first place. How is your workforce adapting?
They're doing great, honestly. I think everyone understands the severity of the situation, and I think they're all well motivated to serve the community, and they're happy to have jobs. And we were lucky to have a great team before this happened, and it's just strengthening the bonds of the team. And so far, we haven't had any issues with that.
And Annalise, for workers in restaurants and hospitality and retail who have been laid off, what can they be doing during this time in order to prepare themselves to rejoin the workforce? Because I'm strongly getting the sense that it's not going to be the same jobs when folks are coming back, that businesses are adapting rapidly, and that, you know, while I think many aspects of this crisis will pass, I think it will be with some changes, perhaps just accelerating changes that were already happening before the coronavirus started.
Yeah. So having studied the programs that we have in place for displaced workers for many years, you know, one of my concerns is that a lot of workers think, oh, my job is just going to come back and I'll be okay. I don't need to think about other things. And I'm very concerned that, you know, especially if this, depending on how long this lasts, that may not be true. And so I do think people need to kind of face the reality head on and start thinking about alternatives. And, you know, in the short run, that might mean, okay, what are some remote jobs that are out there? I know, like, LinkedIn has published articles about remote openings. Also, who's hiring right now. But in the long run, that's where you start to think about training and retraining. And what we've learned from a lot of research is that for adults, you know, just saying go back to school is not very appealing. And not only not appealing, but not affordable when you have mouths to feed and bills to pay. And so I think a big part of our solution moving forward, obviously, I think we can do a lot even right now to build a foundation of online trainings. And there are some that, you know, might be able to get people into a pretty decently paying job fairly quickly. But we have to do some reforms to our what are called our eligible training provider lists for those to qualify for things like WIOA funding, the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. So I think we need to think really hard about how do we make you know, how do we assess quality for online training and come up with some packages quickly, at least to build a small foundation, then we can expand on it later when you can do hybrid learning and other in-person things. But in the meantime, you know, people, if they do want to do something in the meantime and they don't have anything to do at home, I think we should be focused on that. And the second thing I think we need to keep in mind is things like apprenticeships and other on the job learning, because when you get an apprenticeship, you are getting your foot in the door in an employer, you have a mentorship structure, and you're getting paid. You're not getting paid a lot, perhaps, but it's better than having to pay for going to back to school. And you're also making those connections and building those skills in a particular workplace in an applied setting. So I think in the long run, we have to think about how can we devote more resources to helping people make career transitions. We have very little one-on-one support available right now, and we need more of it. But also, how can we get people into on-the-job learning experiences at a much higher higher scale?
Is there anything that laid-off workers can look at right now, or is this just an empty need that needs to be met?
Well, I have heard, it depends on where you are. I think people are still wrapping their heads around this. So in every community, you have American job centers, and you can call them and find out, you know, what do they have. It's going to vary community by community. I know my friends in San Francisco were just telling me that they signed a deal with LinkedIn to offer LinkedIn Learning. So that's one that has gotten off the ground. And I know that I've heard other discussions, But you know, I think this is a world that hasn't really taken off yet in a formal way through public funding. And I think we're kind of under the gun to put some of those package trainings together quickly right now.
Eric, when it is possible for restaurants to fully reopen again, will Soul Spice be able to just throw their doors wide open? Is that going to be like, you know, one day you can just unlock the doors?
I mean, in a perfect world, sure. But, you know, I think we'll be learning a lot of lessons from what happened and maybe even permanently implementing some of these new ideas and how we've been able to serve the communities. I think that's been the most rewarding aspect of this is seeing everyone in the industry really reaching out and trying to reconnect with community assess what everyone's needs are, you know, rather than just selling you a rice bowl. You know, I realize now that I have access to resources that other people need, and we're in a unique position to be able to offer those things.
What about for restaurants that have closed? Do you think that the dining scene will pick up again?
That's really tough. I mean, I sure hope so. I mean, most restaurants, I mean, there are a lot of restaurants that have closed their doors to weather the storm, but, you know, they're in a really tough spot. I mean, their credit lines and capital are being tapped. Business insurance is denying claims for business interruption for anything related to COVID, which is, you know, really difficult. Rent still needs to be paid. I mean, I think there's going to be a long process once this is all over of recovery. And the emphasis really needs to be on that now. The more that we do now, the easier that recovery is going to be for all the restaurants, especially the dine-in restaurants.
What are some things that we can do right now to understand what businesses are going to need in order to reopen?
I think the key right now is just streamlining this process of getting money to businesses. That's the number one concern for all business owners. You know, we hear this news of money and funding being allocated, promises of funding coming in as early as 3 days, and everyone's scrambling to their computers, scrambling to their banks to try to apply, and there is no process. Everyone needs guidance and clarity on how this process works. So I think we really need to focus on that. And also, again, making sure that the funding is allocated not just in one pot, but specifically to different industries so that everyone's can be served.
And David, as you think about what recovery means and looks like for Prince George's County, you know, what's your vision for where Prince George's County is going to be in 5 years?
I think it's a great question. I appreciate you asking that. Let's not in any way diminish the horrible crisis that is facing the nation and the world, the tragedies that are affecting millions and millions of people, certainly in under the pandemic. So I really want to emphasize we're sympathetic to that. But this will be behind us at some point, and I don't know if that's 6 months or a year or so forth, but we, you know, at some point we'll have a vaccine. At some point we'll deal with it as the nation has in the past. So in 5 years, I hope we're looking back with maybe a little getting choked up and a tear in our eye at this terrible time and thinking of all the crazy things that we did for the first time that may, as Eric said, may now be ingrained in a normal pattern 5 years from now. For Prince George's County, I hope we're still number one in the state of Maryland for job growth, and we're continuing to rebrand and reinvent our economy, and that we have thriving transit locations next to our metro stations with wonderful restaurants and apartments and jobs serving our community. We will, as a nation, get past this terrible, terrible time. It's going to take probably longer than any of us on this call right now would like to think. I heard of only a month ago a prediction, maybe 3 weeks ago, a prediction that the nation would have a V-shaped recession. I don't, you know, that's, yeah, a sharp recession that would go down. I don't, unfortunately, believe that. I think we'll be lucky if it's a U-shaped recession. It'll, you know, we're certainly this quarter and the next quarter, there'll be a negative GDP for the nation. But we're going to get through it, and there'll be hard lessons we'll be learned. The nation got through 2000 and you know, what, September 11th and so forth. We've been through wars. We will get through this, and we will get back to a new normal. But it will be a new normal, and I know that we'll all be adjusting our behaviors. Now, in terms of actual real things we can do on the local level, my own family, we made a commitment about once or twice a week. We make sure we do takeout to a local restaurant here in Prince George's County. And we're doing that not only because we're getting tired of cooking, but because we want to support the industry. The county also, by the way, we mentioned the $200 a week card that we give to our $19 an hour workers. There's also a discount program for Prince George County businesses that'll take those cards if they will offer discounts. The idea is to recirculate that. We have a website, by the way, that says if you're a restaurant and you're still open, you can put that information on the website. So we're trying to get people to understand that there will be normality at some point. We'll just have to get through this difficult time.
Nautilus, you know, this has been, you know, we can compare this to 9/11 or to the Great Recession, but this has in many ways been an unprecedented stress test for our safety net. And what have we learned about that safety net, and what's most important to think about for structural reform going forward?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And, you know, I think this is a hard wake up for our safety net. You know, we've had for 30 years, you know, trickle down economics, it's all going to trickle down. And, oh, you know, I think we need that safety net, not just to keep people afloat and businesses afloat, but also revenues coming in the door. So if hardworking folks that are, you know, making very low wages are not protected by our safety net, and then this happens. This is a really big problem, and I think we need to think about modernizing these systems, and we need to think about covering the workers that, as we're seeing right now, are essential. And you know, I think on top of that, I really think in the long run, I want us to think about who doesn't have internet access right now. And, you know, there's a lot of people, if we're moving everything online, they're totally cut off. And, rural areas that don't have broadband. I want to see in 5 years that we have everyone in the U.S. connected and that we have digital training for people so that they know how to stay safe on the internet. That's a really big concern. You know, one of the women I talked to, she said she doesn't have internet and she was trying to apply for unemployment on her phone and it kept kicking her off. So that's that. You know, I'm hoping in 5 years that, you know, my dad owns a very small business. He employs two people. I hope my parents are able to keep their home, honestly, and they're about, you know, they're over retirement age. So, you know, my mom worked as a waitress and cleaned people's houses. These are the things that put food on our table. And I really, my heart goes out to everyone right now who's under really huge amount of stress and distress. And I hope we can get some relief out to people as soon as possible.
And for these workers that are most affected, you know, right now we have these temporary programs that Congress has created. Are there any takeaways from those programs that we should be formalizing into our standard safety net?
I can think of one that jumps off my head, which is yesterday the U.S. Department of Agriculture expanded the online purchasing for SNAP, the food stamp program, into two more states, to California and Arizona. I would love to see every state get that. And you should be able to use your benefits to buy food right now online. And
yeah,
if you do that, that will last. You know, if once you get that up, it'll last.
Yeah, that's a great point. I'm also really struck by the fact that the CARES Act has made unemployment insurance so much more generous, increasing the maximum number of weeks of eligibility for coverage, and increasing the maximum benefit. You know, if we need to do those things right now, why didn't we need to do them before?
Right. Excellent question. Yeah, I mean, people in 2019, people were getting about 36% of their income on average replaced when they use unemployment insurance. So that's terrifying. How are you going to pay your rent if you're, you know, we think of this as a global crisis that is unexpected and it's no one's fault. But, you know, to be honest with you, you know, this could happen at an individual level. You get cancer or there's a fire. In California, we had lots of fire. You know, things displace people that are totally out of their control. And we need safety nets that work, whether it's a pandemic or not.
Thanks for that. And we are coming up on time, so I want to just open up the floor to David and Eric for any last nuggets you want to share.
Well, I think comments are important. I think the nation, the voters of this nation, the taxpayers of this nation, should look back at some of the parts that have been learned or will have been learned, and look in the mirror and decide what they expect from their government, what they're prepared to pay for in taxes, and what type of social net do they want. And if they're happy with it, if they think this was exactly the way it should have played out, that's one thing. They can vote accordingly. But if they are a little disappointed in how the responsiveness came from some levels of government, and I'll exclude my own local level of government, but I think people need to think about what they want from government and were they happy with the response they got, particularly from the federal government.
Well, Eric, I'm gonna close with you. I really hope that at some point Sol Spice gets back to growth mode.
Thanks so much. And just as a reminder, I just hope that everyone follows in David's footsteps and goes out and supports their local restaurants right now. And I'm sure everyone here is becoming a master baker, but we need all the help and support that we can get.
Okay, thanks for your time, everyone. And we have some additional resources on brookings.edu that we're gonna share on a closing card now.